Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hi, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is wonderful.
Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for, I feel your spirit in the studio. You ever do that? You ever feel like the listener, like they're in here with us and it's like, you know, they're like ghosts or angels or something and there's two of them because there's two of us, right? And so one of them's behind me and they have their little spectral hands on my shoulders, and then there's one behind you with their hands on your shoulders, but I see that and I'm like, that's my wife. Do you ever do that?
You know, I took a lot of creative writing classes and they talked about how some writers have like a particular person in mind that they are writing to.
Interesting.
That helps them kind of focus their work and their voice.
So who's your ghost angel that you're writing for?
Ghost angel.
Mine is named, his name is Thomas, and he lives in Detroit. And he loves alt comedy and podcasting.
Uh-huh.
And it's going straight to Thomas.
Uh-huh. Mine is Connie Britton.
Oh, yeah. Can't go wrong there. If you make something for Connie Britton, it's going to be a crowd pleaser.
Uh-huh.
Pretty much no matter what.
Yeah.
Do you have any small wonders, though, is what I'm wondering.
I'm going to say Valentine's Day stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Just like the candy, the cookies, the treats.
Oh, my.
I went to Trader Joe's. They had all of their little seasonal Valentine's things out, and I just pushed them into my cart aggressively.
Yeah, I had myself a little snack attack last night, didn't I? little gummy X's and O's. I had some of them. I had some of those chocolate-covered shortbread hearts. Mm-hmm. Good stuff, good stuff.
I know that it is basically the same thing I could buy year-round, but when it is in a little seasonal shape, I'm just like, well, that has to belong to me now.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
We just started, well, I'll say Ozark. We started watching Ozark. It's not our kind of show. It's very bleak.
Yeah.
Oppressively bleak, I would argue.
Yeah, we're only in the first season, so it may get worse. You know?
Probably will. It's like Breaking Bad, but like less fun. I'm describing it. I don't know why.
There's no build up. I was telling Griffin, with Breaking Bad, you get some time to like get used to this life of crime.
Yeah.
Whereas Ozark, it's literally nasty, episode one.
Nasty.
Episode one
jump.
Is like, hey, there's crime.
Yeah. So I never feel great after finishing an episode, but I get it now. I get why people have been talking about this show for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's okay to watch a little, you know, a prestige, grim, dark drama like this from time to time. Not my usual cup of tea, but you know, we need something to watch.
Yes.
There's a new season of the glass blowing show on Netflix.
I know. I didn't watch the first season.
Oh,
well, so now we can experience it together.
There's no point. You'll miss out on all the important plot points. I think I go first this week.
Great.
I prepped this first subject without realizing that it is very kind of similar to a subject that I brought last week when I talked about trading card games and Pokemon and stuff like that. But I saw an article pop up about this thing, and it's not so much the thing I like as the concept of the thing, and it is the concept of Beanie Babies and the investment. And listen, this is not, I do not want to judge the people who got snookered into the Beanie Baby habit. Because there, but for the grace of God, went I.
This feels like a real pivotal moment in our relationship for a lot of reasons.
Okay.
But largely because I don't think of you as much of a collector.
Are you really, babe? You don't think of me as much as, should I open my closet door for you where I have all my dark collections?
Yeah, I guess you're not regularly on the eBay.
No.
You don't have a bunch of doodads that are like spilling out into all the rooms of our house. Like,
no, I keep them neatly organized in my office closet.
Maybe this is just like a little secret little habit that I just haven't really explored with you.
I mean, it depends on what you call a collection, right? I have probably 500 different video games in my closet right there. I'd say I probably have been collecting those across different generations for most of my life.
I guess collections can be what you hold on to and not an active habit.
Right. Most of my Beanie Baby collecting took place through the McDonald's Teeny Beanies, which even then I remember like getting a Happy Meal with a Teeny Beanie inside it and getting it and being like, oh, this is going to be my nest egg.
How does it feel for you to say teeny beanie?
Not great. Not great. But people used to say shit like that all the time in the 90s. Uh-huh. So this is 90s kids, Mimba. I really do want to talk about this because I know our audience skews young. And I think that sort of through cultural osmosis, people probably know about Beanie Babies. But I don't know that everybody really recognizes the true depths of depravity that people went through to get their hands on these little guys. If you don't know, Beanie Babies were these little, wildly understuffed kind of rag dolls that looked like different animals with different sort of colorful cloth exteriors that were stuffed with these tiny little, what were they, like PVC, like little beads.
Yeah, like a beanbag. I mean, stuffed in the way that a beanbag is, so it's kind of floppy.
Yeah, they were not very full, which some folks took as a knock on the quality of the Beanie Baby line. Ty Warner, who created Beanie Babies and was the titular founder of Ty Inc., the company that made Beanie Babies, he said that understuffing them like that made them look, quote, real. I like that. I like that a lot. So this first line of nine Beanie Babies launched from Ty Inc. in 1993. And those nine are like among the most quote unquote valuable, but I will get to the value of these stuffed toys here in a moment. But they really didn't take off until late 1995. And that's when Beanie buying fever kind of hit its zenith. There were two main reasons why like this was such a thing in the late 90s and why they attracted all of these collectors. And the first is that Ty Inc. was vicious about artificial scarcity of these dolls. They would only release like a certain number of each model of Beanie Baby and then would just stop selling them, stop manufacturing them entirely, and then would move on to the next model and do the exact same thing, right? So there was never this like overwhelming surplus of certain models of Beanie Babies. They also all had these tags on them, and the tags would have the birthday for the Beanie Baby and a little poem for the Beanie Baby.
Yeah.
And because the speed with which they were manufacturing these, there were a lot of typos on those tags. So if you had one,
oh my gosh,
from like a limited set with a typo tag or some, you know, rare tag, then the value of it sort of multiplied, right? And the way that they really tapped into their consumer base, and this was kind of revolutionary at the time, in late 1995, Ty Inc. made a website that they would post the link to on these tags, like, hey, go to tyinc.com or whatever the website was to learn more about this Beanie Baby and find out more about like its value and what the next line of Beanie. And they were really the first ones to like interact with customers through their website, which seems like that's the only reason websites exist now.
Yeah.
But in 1995, like nobody was really doing it like that.
Yeah, it's true.
And so, you know, you had this market of artificial scarcity and then this website for information for collectors to go and like learn all about their shit. And because of that, like 1995 to 1998, like Beanie Babies were like buck wild and people were buying them and seeking them out. eBay during this period, like 10% of all sales on eBay were Beanie Babies of people who would like find them and then flip them for a profit and sell them to collectors in these like, you know, big clear plastic resin boxes that were hermetically sealed and would be a down payment on a house in the future. Certain dolls that were very, very valuable. Again, I put that in quotes, the Princess Diana Beanie Baby.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. That is where I remember like realizing like, oh, this is a kind of a weird thing.
Yeah. they made a limited run that I think they sent like 12 dolls each to vendors. So each vendor would only have a run of 12 dolls. And then of that run, there was a first printing that had a like misprint on the tag. And so in 2017, it was the 20th anniversary. They released this doll in 1997. 20th anniversary. These dolls started to show up again on these different websites of people selling them for like $60,000.
Oh my gosh.
One, I think, sold it for like $500,000 in like this pristine box. And as far as anyone can tell, none of those ever sold. Because the cruel joke of Beanie Babies is that they aren't really worth anything. You can buy one of those Princess Beanie Babies on eBay for like, I saw one for like $15. I saw one for like at the max, like in its like ultra rare form, like $100 on eBay.
Yeah.
And so there is no value to the Beanie Baby. And is that a cruel twist of fate for people who, you know, sunk some cash into this, hoping that one day they'd be able to turn around and sell this understuffed Princess Diana bear for, you know, $60,000?
You're really big on this understuffed thing. This is what really gets to you.
It's not a good. I had some. They did a lot of licensed Beanie Babies in sort of late Beanie Baby era, in like 99. I think they did Pokemon. I definitely had like that kind of thing, of like a Vulpix or whatever. But the idea of people saying these tiny little ragdoll toys, I've been put on this earth to buy them, and then one day I will become a very rich person. And then like now in 2021, we have the context of looking back and saying like, those were bad stuffed animals. Of course they were never going to be worth anything, but there was this thing. I feel like it's a common thing for collectors, like baseball cards, Pokemon cards, certainly, although Pokemon cards have bucked the curve because some of those are extremely valuable still these days. Beanie Babies never really got over the hump of being an actual worthwhile investment.
Yeah, I mean, it's primarily a children's toy, and typically that is not, you know, where one really makes their money.
No.
You know, on Antiques Roadshow, I feel like it's more rare that you see a stuffed animal as like a, will you appraise this item?
Our first hint should have been when they started giving them away in Happy Meals, is that these items would never be particularly valuable.
Yeah, you say that, but McDonald's toys, I don't know. There's like something about it. Like people will get the set and they will sell it. I mean, not for a lot of money, but There's something about like a set and a number and a limited time release that you still kind of think, well, I mean, if nobody else can get it after this time window, then maybe it is valuable.
But then you think that there's 5 million people saying the exact same thing, and maybe it's not. I don't want to poke fun at people who get bought into, you know, not get rich quick schemes, but investment schemes like this. But I do want to say that, like, building your hopes, building your like sort of investment portfolio around these poorly stuffed bears is like, as far as hopes go, like pretty delightful to me.
There is a suggestion in the way you're phrasing this that if only they had been stuffed a little more, you could buy into.
If they'd been stuffed more, then nobody would have ever given a shit about these guys.
I mean, it's just like gambling, right? Like there are opportunities to potentially make money.
Right.
And if you enjoy it, you know, you go for it.
Right.
You know, I don't see a whole lot of difference between this and like people who, you know, bet on horse races.
No, I mean, I again held on to Pokemon cards for a very long time thinking that they would be worth some money. And then it was worth some money.
Yeah.
And today would be worth much more money. So like, yeah, no, if sliding doors, man. The Princess Diana doll could be worth $1 billion in some world,
How strange for somebody to pass from this earth and be brought back in a stuffed bear.
Right, that people then go out and seek out, thinking it'll be worth millions of dollars someday. Yes, it's a strange twist of fate. I don't know much about Princess Diana, but that doesn't seem like it was sort of her vibe, necessarily.
How did they decide on the animal, I wonder?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know if she was a big bear person.
I don't know either. Again, I know very little about Princess Diana, and I'm sorry for that. I just don't know. I know lots of other stuff. What's your first thing?
So I don't typically take requests on this show.
Yeah, that's wild.
I usually just kind of go with my gut.
Yeah.
But it happened that the requests in my gut kind of lined up.
Okay.
With this National Poetry Corner.
Oh, yeah.
Focused on Amanda Gorman.
We almost went to this National Poetry Corner last week before the inauguration.
I don't know what I was thinking. I wanted to do it last week because I knew that she was going to give the inaugural poem. But not having heard the inaugural poem, it felt like a big swing. Not that she was going to come out and like, really?
My name's Amanda Gorman, and I'm here to say that I love democracy in a major way. No, I don't think anybody assumed.
I didn't think she was going to, like, you know, put up an air ball. But I also felt like, I mean, she's very young. She's 22.
Yeah.
There is not a lot to pull from. She has one book of poems out.
Yeah.
Her second book of poems and actually a children's book are set to come out in September.
Right.
So there just wasn't a lot of content, and there also weren't a lot of articles. It wasn't really until after the inauguration that she kind of blew up, and now there's tons of information about her.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring her this week in this National Poetry Corner.
I just watched it this morning. I talked to you about this, that I didn't watch the inauguration because of just sort of general, you know, political anxiety you know, skepticism, I would say, in general of what's happening right now. But it seems sort of inarguably inarguably uplifting. Like, everything else aside of, like, what the new administration, like, might mean from a, you know, practical standpoint. Like, putting all that aside, like, it was a fucking great poem and a really, really genuinely powerful moment.
Yeah. And this is an easy thing to track down right now if you want to go look. The poem she wrote specifically for the inauguration was called The Hill We Climb. You can find a lot of videos of it.
Watch the full thing. It's like 5 minutes long.
I excerpted some particularly powerful little lines, images that I'm going to share. But yeah, if you want to see the whole thing in its entirety, which I recommend you do, you can find it. But she told the New York Times in advance of this performance, she said, "In my poem, I'm not going to in any way gloss over what we've seen over the past few weeks, and dare I say the past few years. But what I really aspire to do in the poem is to be able to use my words to envision a way in which our country can still come together and can still heal," which I think is what made it so powerful for people.
Yeah.
There was nothing about her poem that I found to be like, you know, too optimistic, too sunshiny. You know, she's very
absolutely
straightforward. Like, part of being America is going through some really terrible stuff. Like, democracy at its core is people kind of fighting for what they want. And there's been a lot of that lately, and it has been kind of gross. And that doesn't mean necessarily that we're broken forever.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you have the line, the one that stood out to me and I saw people talking about it, is the being American is more than the pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it.
That's exactly
fucking incredible.
That's exactly it.
I heard that line once this morning and like it stuck with me that hard.
Yeah, I would plan to include that one because I found it so powerful. She went from, this is kind of like an arbitrary measurement, but it kind of communicates the impact. She went from 7,000 Twitter followers to 1.4 million.
Yeah.
And it was powerful for me, like, just to see all these people on Twitter. I mean, obviously there was a range. They're like, oh, there were a lot of people that were like, that is an incredible poem. And then there were people like, she should be president.
Yeah.
Like, it was, but like, no matter what, it was like a bunch of people like hearing somebody read a poem and feeling like so moved by it. And it was just like on this national stage. And it just, particularly on Twitter, it was just surreal to just see all these people like, I love this poem. And it was like, this doesn't happen on Twitter.
Yeah.
So I was telling Griffin, there were parts of it that reminded me a lot of like performance, like slam poetry, particularly with like the wordplay and the rhythm of it. And so I just wanted to read a little.
And her body, but not body section. Language, like her like actual hand movements,
the like gesticulation.
Yeah.
It felt very performance poetry focused. Okay, so here's the part I wanted to read. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace, and the norms and notions of what just is isn't always justice. And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. Isn't that incredible? Like that reminds me a lot of like, you know, when I was in Chicago going to these like performance poetry like events and feeling like kind of like, oh, okay, I know how this works. Like there's a formula to performance poetry and there's a rhythm and you just kind of have to find words that fit in their rhythm. But that kind of like focus on just like the meaning of word and like the meter of it and the message behind it is just incredible.
Yeah. It's like it was this like very, very beautiful and poignant like outline of the tremendous amount of work that is still required and the tremendous amount of like accountability that like everybody needs to hold themselves to.
Yeah.
And seeing that in like an inauguration, which is typically a little bit more sort of like straightforward, optimistic, like here come the good days. Yeah. Not that poem wasn't saying that, but as much as it was saying like, you have to work for those good days. And my God, there is so much to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that there is optimism to be found in that work,
right?
You know, that it is hard and that it is obviously not the circumstance you want to be in, but that it is just part of what being like a good citizen can be. So she is the first National Youth Poet Laureate. Obviously, there's been poet laureates for a long time now, but she is the first National Youth Poet Laureate, and she's been that since 2017. She went to Harvard, and that is when she became a National Youth Poet Laureate. And her first book came out in 2015.
When she was 17 years old, if I'm doing that, or six, how old was she in 2017? How long ago was that?
That was four years
ago. So she was 18.
Yeah.
Phew.
Yeah. She has started a organization called One Pen, One Page, which provides free creative writing programs for underserved youth.
Cool.
Yeah. I don't know exactly. It's still kind of new. We're still finding things out about her. So it is hard for me to really know like how she has made all of this happen. The thing that got a lot of attention is that she had a speech impediment. And a lot of reason that got attention was because Joe Biden also
had a
stuttering issue. And so she has an auditory disorder that makes her hear and process information differently from other people. And she was still struggling that while in college. She said that like particularly letters like R were still difficult for her and that she, in order to kind of become better at her pronunciation, started learning all of the lyrics to Hamilton.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of the connection. And people have noticed that there were some references to Hamilton in her inaugural poem. But other than that, it's hard to kind of find information. She's born and raised in Los Angeles. She has a twin sister. Her mom is a middle school English teacher. And now she's world famous. Yeah. She's gotten like endless numbers of offers. Apparently she just got a modeling contract.
Whoa.
In addition to, you know, all of her accolades. It's very exciting. You know, I think the inaugural poet, you know, there is a clip of Maya Angelou's inaugural poem, which apparently was very inspirational to Amanda Gorman. Like there are poems throughout inauguration history that have kind of changed the world.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of them.
It's an important thing to not to talk about like the priorities of recovering from COVID-19 because this is, you know, there's so much. But I have a lot of friends who are essentially like displaced theater workers and performing artists and stuff like that. And I know it was powerful for them to see this much weight and attention given to something that has largely gone by the wayside when talking about like what needs help right now. Like, yeah. The performing arts are in very dire straits, as are a lot of industries, but you know, unlike a lot of industries, performing arts is seen as like, you know, frivolous and kind of, yeah, unnecessary. But like, when it comes to sort of capturing the contents of the, you know, our soul on a sort of national historic level, like a incredibly good poem is kind of what got the job done. And so I know it's been sort of it's been fulfilling, I think, to a lot of yeah, my friends who are out of work right now, to see people kind of like pay attention to performing arts in such a like meaningful way.
Yeah. And not to mention too, like, we haven't talked about the impact of her as a young person that is Black performing a poem,
yeah,
at a presidential inauguration. Like, the idea that that could inspire just a whole new generation of young Black writers is really,
yeah,
is really cool.
That's rad. Hey, can I steal you away?
Yes.
Thank you. Hey, we got a couple of Jump Johns here, and I'm going to start reading the first one because it is for Kinney, and it is from Michael and David, who say, "Your non-binary journey has been deeply moving and inspiring, and we are so proud to call you a Sib. We can't wait till we can start gathering again at the old board game cafe for all our celebratory occasions and spend all day playing board games, drinking beer, and eating those good, good nachos. Much love from your brotherly Changri Changri Chippos." Holy shit. First of all, incredibly sweet message. Loving that. But the idea also of sitting at a board game cafe and playing board games while drinking beers and eating nachos actually took my breath away. The thought of being able to do that took my breath away and gives, yeah, me hope for the future.
Gosh. Yeah, you know, that is one food that doesn't travel well. Griffin and I have talked a lot about how difficult it is to get nachos delivered to your house and have them be in a condition that is satisfactory.
Not doable. Not doable. We could learn to make our own nachos.
I know, yeah. It seems like it probably would be pretty easy.
Not to make them good, like, I don't know.
Yeah, well, see, the problem is we do a lot of microwave, and I feel like
it's got to be oven. And
yeah, the cast iron skillet is really, I think, the way to go.
Absolutely. Unless we did the trash can nacho. We'll talk after the show.
Okay.
We could probably find a recipe online for Guy Fieri's trash can nachos.
Can I read this next message?
Yeah, should I start looking on my phone for that recipe while you read it?
Sure. This message is for Bunny. It is from Julie. Hi, Bunny. Thank you for introducing me to my favorite show with these two married cuties. I love you, and hopefully we can be two married cuties as well one day. Thank you for being my wonderful thing. Love, Julie.
That is so sweet.
That is so sweet
and romance. And I liked it, and it made me feel good.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you see a sweet, good romance, and you're like, oh, that makes me feel good. You ever do that? Like the lake house?
Like the lake house. Yes. Those are some cuties in, yeah, the lake house.
Did you see that picture that Guy Fieri tweeted of him with Bernie Sanders photoshopped into his,
yeah,
car? He said, not me, us. I was like, damn, Guy Fieri. Welcome to the fucking resistance, Guy Fieri.
that did shake the internet, because at first everyone's like, oh, he's getting in on this. Wait a minute. What does that mean?
Anyway, the romance is very good. Folks, I'm recording this ad by myself because Rachel, she did something totally wild. She hopped on her electric e-bike and she was like, I am out of here. And then she zoomed off. She hit a ramp and flew up in the sky like an E.T. movie, and just went so fast that I was like, dang, where'd my wife even go? And she yelled from over the horizon on a bike adventure. And so I have to celebrate that. I have to cheer for her on that. This bike that Rachel got from Electric E-Bike, it is, one, very sleek and stylish. It looks fast, because it is. The battery lasts forever. It shows up at your door, ships for free. It's got a quick toolless assembly, and you can even fold it up for easy travel and storage. It is the perfect time of year to have a sweet little bike for yourself to go on your own bike adventures away from your husband. Anyway, go full throttle into spring with Lectric e-bikes, the number one selling e-bikes in the nation. Get your adventure started at lectricebikes.com, and please mention that Wonderful sent you in the post-checkout survey. That's L-E-C-T-R-I-C ebikes.com.
I'm going first. It's me, Jackie Cation.
Man, she's always this bossy. Hi. I'm Lori Kilmartin. We're a bunch of stand-up comics, and we've been doing comedy like 60 years total, both of us, but we look amazing.
Working out. We drop every Monday on Max Fun, and it's called The Jackie Lori Show, and you could listen to it and learn about comedy and learn about anger management and all the things.
And Jackie is married but childless, and I'm unmarried but child full. So together, we make one complete woman.
Is that just what that one's going to end?
Yeah. And we try to make Kyle laugh just like that and say, oh my God, every episode.
It's a good job.
Jackie and Lori Show, Mondays, only on Maximum Fun.
My second thing is going to be fairly brief, I think. I don't know that I have a lot to say about my second thing, but we went on a walk this past weekend with our son, walked by something that I realized I kind of wanted to talk about, and that thing is honeysuckle. Honeysuckle. You like honeysuckle?
Sure, we haven't talked about this.
I looked on the website, didn't see nothing about honeysuckle.
Huh.
On wonderful.fyi. It feels like we have, huh?
Yeah.
There must have been some other sort of sweet-smelling plant that we talked about.
It's possible that I was going to bring it and then thought, there's not enough here.
But you didn't have the sort of keen analytical
I don't have the chops.
Honeysuckle sense.
I don't have the chops that you do.
You got me freaked out. So I'm going to, no, there is no honeysuckle entry on the wonderful.fyi website.
All right.
So if it is a dupe, take it up with them. Honeysuckle. It is a very, very, it's a real stinker of a plant. I don't think I realized that it is a hugely invasive species.
Yeah. I mean, you never see just like
a little bit.
A little tiny bit of honeysuckle.
I had a neighbor growing up who I was very close friends with. And in her backyard, her like back fence was this wooden fence that was just like, just completely covered in honeysuckle. Yeah. And it was so deep, like this shrub that we like made a burrow in it, essentially, that you could kind of climb into, and we had like a little secret honeysuckle for it. So like I am not a botanist. I am not like, I don't know shit about trees or plants or anything, but I find it very exciting whenever I am walking and I recognize through scent first, like a plant, or I recognize like what that smell is. And honeysuckle for me is like one of those very recognizable smells. And it also is like deeply nostalgic for me. I loved plucking the like actual flowers off, and then you can kind of pull the stamen, I guess, or the pistil out through the bottom of it, and then like eat the nectar of it. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that a lot of the berries, a lot of the species of honeysuckle, the actual like berry there on it is poisonous.
Oh, that seems risky.
Seems a little bit risky, but you know, you got to risk it for the biscuit. And by the biscuit, I mean the nectar. But that was such an eye-opening thing for me, like realizing that you can eat that nectar. And all of a sudden, like, I started to look around at nature like it was like, you know, the Willy Wonka like candy room. Like, what other of these plants can I eat?
I could never tell like what made a blossom more likely to pay off. You know, like sometimes there's those real juicy ones.
There's really juicy.
Sometimes you get like nothing. And I could never figure out like, what is the method here?
Well, there would be big ones that you would see that and be like, I bet that's got a lot of nectar. But they would be open in a way where the nectar wouldn't really collect on the stamen when you pulled it out. I got good at identifying those. Mm. And I would just tear down 30 or 40 of those bad boys. Just be full of nectar like a big bee. Actually, it's not bees. Do you know who loves the honeysuckle? Moth. Moths love the honeysuckle.
Oh,
drop a little larva in there, and the larva will eat it up, come out just strong with nectar energy. There is a species that is called Lonicera japonica that is so invasive all over the northern hemisphere. Like pretty much every continent's got this bad boy. And it is also grown as a commercial crop because it is used in some traditional Chinese medicine.
Oh.
So like, it's funny to think like this pest, like a lot of people, a lot of gardeners and botanists see it as a pest, is also grown for commercial purposes for traditional Chinese medicine, which I think is kind of delightful. But they're like a really common garden plant for their sort of aesthetic properties. Like if you have a ugly shed or some sort of wall that you don't want people to be able to see, you plant a little bit of honeysuckle there, and within minutes, it is just going to be completely occupied. It'll be honeysuckle country. And they are really, really very, very strong plants. Like it is kind of tough to get honeysuckle out. It grows in it's a twining climber, which means it will wrap around the thing sort of naturally in a helix as it grows on it. So then, you know, once it's on there, it's kind of difficult to get off. And the stems are very, very strong too. They've been used for textiles and for, you know, rope and twine and the like. I just like it. I really don't have much else to say about honeysuckle, except that I really, it's one of my favorite sort of like herbal smells, one of my favorite like plant smells. Mm-hmm. And I don't like a lot of plant smells. I find them kind of overpowering. But you get some honeysuckle, it's just like a nice little sugary treat for your nose.
Yeah.
It sounds like I just described cocaine. I didn't mean to describe cocaine. I just think it's cool.
Yeah. No, there's something like very strong about being a kid and being able to like
eat a plant.
Yeah, to just find something, know that you can put it in your mouth, and just doing it you're only young once, and summertime, and
that devil may care attitude of just eating honeysuckles in the summertime. I remember once we cooked like dandelions. I think like her mom knew how to like cook dandelions in like sugar water or something. God, this is a weird memory. Maybe it was just a sick prank that was played on us children.
Well, their dandelion wine is like a real thing.
Yeah, but we were children. So I don't know that was necessarily what was going on there. Honeysuckle, catch it. Catch the wave. What's your second thing? But it's not as cool as honeysuckle. But you wouldn't have as much to talk about as I had to talk about with honeysuckle, which I think we can all agree was a pretty exhaustive discussion of the plant honeysuckle.
My second thing.
Yeah.
Which has kind of come up in other topics, but we've never really focused on animal migration.
Just in general, the idea that animals go from one place to mm-hmm. the other to survive? Okay.
Yeah. Like we talked about the bats.
Yeah.
You know, but all major animal groups have species that migrate.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm going to start whales, salmon, and a lot of birds. I think that's about it that I know about.
Well, there's also crustaceans.
Crustaceans, do you say?
Mm-hmm. You know what? You didn't mention wolves.
Wolves. Gosh, mm-hmm. they're always sort of roaming around, mm-hmm. huh?
But only 1,800 of the world's 10,000 bird species migrate.
Oh, okay.
When I was a kid, I thought it was like all the birds.
I thought pretty much every bird went ahead and left.
I just remember like not really seeing many birds and figuring that literally every single bird had gone south and wondering what it was like to be south and to have all of the birds.
Probably shitty.
Just every bird. I mean, we see a little bit of that in Texas, I feel like. Like an increase in bird.
Yeah, there's definitely a grackle-pocalypse that does happen at certain times of year.
So animal migration is defined as the long-distance movement of individual animals, usually on a seasonal basis. And it encompasses four related concepts, which include persistent straight movement, relocation of an individual on a greater scale than its normal daily activities, seasonal to and fro movement of a population between two areas, and movement leading to the redistribution of individuals within a population.
Okay.
So it is not uncommon within a species that not all individuals migrate. So it's not like you turn around and every single bird of a species is gone. It's like some of them hang back. Some of that is due to age or sex, like just depends on the circumstance.
Right. I guess that makes sense.
But yeah, I just had always thought like all the geese, every goose.
I mean, the geese that hang back have to be at risk, right? Like there's a reason why.
For sure.
Okay.
For sure. But they, I mean, there are limited resources available, but I imagine there are still enough resources for a drastically reduced population.
They got to be cold, though.
Yeah, no, I know.
I'm going to go. It's still kind of cold outside. I'm going to go find a goose right now and take good care of them.
And this migration is like real intense for some animals. The caribou can travel as much as 3,000 miles in a year. The gray wolves can go even farther. So they track a lot of these animals, scientists do, to just kind of see the distance. And they found a gray wolf that traveled 4,500 miles.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember watching on the Kratt Brothers show that monarch butterflies, the distance that they travel is equivalent to if a human being walked all the way around the earth four times. That's a pretty long journey, huh?
Yeah, that's a long one.
Thanks, Kratt Brothers. I just impressed my wife with some zoological knowledge. Thanks, Kratt Brothers.
So I mentioned crustaceans. So there is a crab called the Christmas Island red crab.
I love him already.
Which lives on Christmas Island, which is in the Indian Ocean.
Is this just one crab? So far, I feel like you've been talking about just one crab called the Christmas crab.
No.
Just say yes. Just say yes, Griffin. There's a Christmas crab that lives on Christmas Island. He makes Christmas wishes come true. He's got a little sort of sleigh made out of chitin, and he's got a dolphin with a red nose, and he gives an octopus 8 presents.
I mean, that's really nice.
And it's true. Just say, and it's what? And it's the truth.
And it's just him and 43 million of his friends who also deliver presents to sea creatures.
Okay.
They all do.
They work together on it. Now this is starting to make some sense.
They all use their little crabs and they put together little tiny gifts and they hold on to them with their little pinchers. And
I bet they crush a lot of those gifts accidentally, though. I love you, Christmas crab.
Well, then you would not be a fan of the yellow crazy ant.
Yellow crazy ant? Who named that?
I don't know. That's its own topic, though. I didn't even click on yellow crazy ant because I want to surprise myself with that later.
Okay.
But apparently there was accidentally this yellow crazy ant was introduced and really...
To what? Introduced to what?
Into the island and really put a hit on that Christmas crab.
Oh, man.
Killed about 10 to 15 million of these in recent years.
Wow. I would not say yellow crazy ant. I would say rude ant. Yellow mean ant.
So these crabs, they make an annual mass migration to the sea to lay their eggs in the ocean.
I like that.
But they're okay. They're not like on a list of endangered or anything.
Of endangered crabs.
This ant is really putting
a hurt on
them.
I'm about to put those ants on the endangered ant list because I'm going to go to Christmas Island with my biggest boots and I'm going to squish every single one of those.
Oh my gosh, they should be called Grinch ants.
They should be definitely called Grinch ants. They're not going to be called anything. They're going to be called goo on the sand. Goo on the sand when I squish I'm not kidding, every single one of them.
Well, be careful, Griffin, because they're crazy.
I don't, look at me. I do not care. I do not care. I will not be defeated by ants.
So yeah, so migration, lots of fish do it, 120 species of fish. You mentioned the butterfly. There's also dragonflies that do it.
Oh.
There's a desert locust that flies westward across the Atlantic Ocean. It's a thing that a lot of animals do, sometimes by choice, sometimes just kind of their whole rhythm. For example, like birds are kind of set up to like feel this like undeniable pull to move.
Right.
And it's just, I don't know, it's just a really cool thing. I would like to have a little summer place I go in the winter, you know?
I think everybody does.
Yeah.
I think for some of us, it's Christmas Island. Or it was. We got work to do. If we want to move to Christmas Island, we're going to have to do some stuff there that we're not going to want to talk about later to some ants.
Yeah.
This is all I'm going to be able to think about today.
What is, I think, like a giant picnic basket. And you just lure them all in there.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's all.
All right. Do you want to know what our friends at home are talking about?
Yes.
Well, okay. Aaron says, something I find wonderful is the smell and feel of a warm stack of warm papers fresh from the laser printer. Ooh, that's good.
That is good.
My mom was a secretary at our church that like we grew up going to, and I spent so much time like in her office, just like kicking it on a weekday when, you know, there was nobody to like hang out with me at home. And so I would use the Xerox printer to like, you know, copy my hand or my face or like whatever.
Yeah.
And the smell of that Xerox printer and like the warmth of the paper as it came out of it is like a huge like sense memory, I feel like.
I got in trouble for doing that once.
Oh, no.
My mom taught kindergarten for years and years, and I went in and tried to make some fun copies for myself.
Oh, no.
And the principal yelled at me.
Oh, my goodness. That's rough. Rain says, my small wonder is every once in a while, the air in my town smells like oranges. I live about 5 miles away from the Tropicana factory, and when they burn orange peels, the whole town smells like oranges. It's great. That is great.
Whoa.
I can't say that I would love it forever. I don't know. It feels like if you get that smell a little too much.
I don't know. I think I would love it forever. It's like the cookie smell in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Or the Heiner's bread smell in Huntington. It's a real smell. Heiner's Bread Factory makes a good smell out in, if you're out in the Stand. Oof.
Do you ever get tired of it?
No, not really, because yeah, I didn't live in the Stand. Like, I worked in the Stand, so I would you know, go down there and get the stink.
Hey, I'm going to say this, and you can put it on a t-shirt if you want, but some smells are just always good smells.
I don't know why I'd put that on a t-shirt. Hey, thank you to Bowen and Augustus for these for our theme song, Money Won't Pay. You can find a link to that in the episode description. And thank you to MaximumFun.org for having us on the network. Go to MaximumFun.org. Check out all the great shows that they have on MaximumFun.org. I mean, they got Switchblade Sisters and Triple Click and Story Break. And
that's very true. Minority Corner.
Minority Corner. And a whole bunch more.
Oh, hey, you've got a book out.
Hey, I do. Dang it. Wouldn't you know it? I regret to inform you that
every time you turn around,
another book has come out written by me and Justin and Travis mm-hmm. It was with special guests, our lovely wives. And it's called Everybody Has a Podcast Except You. And it's a lot of people are saying the definitive guide to creating a podcast.
Yeah. And I want to emphasize, too, because I know not everybody wants to make a podcast. There was a period of time in my life when I did not want to make a podcast.
But then you found out where all the money is.
I still would have read this book is what I'm saying.
Oh, OK. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. And it's written for people who have like no audio engineering or hosting experience or anything.
Yeah.
It's for you to make something. And I think that's going to be it. So hang in there. Stay tough and vigilant and safe. And
but also
but
soft.
Also risk it.
And unobservant.
Be soft and hard.
And dangerous.
And dangerous. Be, I guess, everything.
Just be.
Just, ooh, that's it. That's it.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.